We would like to thank Karen and Jake Abelevis for sponsoring this morning's Locks and Learn, Lila Nishmas, Jake's beloved parents, Eliyahu ben Abba and Leah Bas Avraham, and Karen's brother Yeshua ben Shimon Dov, the Neshama should have an Aliyah. We are in the midst of learning about the sixth Mishnah in the fifth chapter of Pirkei Avos, 10 things that were created. The Erev Shabbos of creation at twilight, Bein Hashmashos, and last week we went through a quick reading of the 10, plus the additional 4 that are added on by others. We'll quickly read through them. The mouth of the earth, the mouth of the well, the mouth of the donkey, the rainbow, the manna, the staff of Moses, the shamir, the letters, the writing and the tablets, and some say the demons, the grave of Moses, the ram of Abraham, and some also say the tongues, because you need a first tongues to be made in order to make the subsequent tongues. Okay, so those are the list of the 14. We started off relatively slowly going through the first 3. I don't even think we finished it. I think we did the first 2. So what we're going to do today is we're going to see the first 3, review what we did for the first 2, see the third one, and then do a little off script. What I have planned for today is different than we usually do. What we're going to be doing is seeing basically excerpts from a book called Bewilderments, written by Dr. Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg. She is a very deep thinker. She has a PhD, I believe, in English literature. And she quotes a lot of English literature. She quotes a lot of deep psychology and a lot of deep chassidus. What we're going to see is that throughout this book, Bewilderments, which is her book on Sefer Bamidbar, that there this running theme of speech comes up over and over and over again. She actually references at one point our Mishnah, and we're going to try to get a feel for the deeper symbolism of what speech in Bamidbar represents. It's going to be deep. I'm not even sure I totally understand every detail, because it's pretty in-depth, but we'll try to do a clear as we can reading. I think it'll be worth it. Again, it's a little bit off script, a little bit different than our usual type of shiur, but I think it'll be beneficial for our understanding of this Mishnah, our understanding of Sefer Bamidbar, and hopefully we will have a deeper appreciation of language and speech as well. So with that, let us briefly recap some of the classical commentaries that we saw last week and read one more before we delve into what Dr. Zornberg has to say. So last week we ended off with the Tosfos Yom Tov. And the Tosfos Yom Tov was elaborating on what the Pi Haaretz means, right? So the first of the 10 things listed is the mouth of the earth, presumably referencing the mouth of the earth as it relates to being swallowing up Korach's followers. So the Tosfos Yom Tov explained that the mouth of the earth, it was intricate, it was complicated, it was detailed. We'll spare the details for now, but just the main point was that the mouth of the earth that he was referencing here is not just that the earth swallowed up the people, but is that the earth actually was speaking, as it were. It was making sounds, it was making noise, and that was the miracle. So the reference to speech here is our first hint that that this isn't just about an earth swallowing up. The word P is used in terms of the speech. Now, let's then see an idea. I don't believe we saw this last week. The Pi HaBe'er, the mouth of the well. So in presumably we're talking about the well of Miriam, which is related to perhaps the rock that Moshe hit, because once Miriam died, there was no more water. So what does this have to do with anything? So on a surface level, perhaps just the water coming out of a mouth, it's sort of there's an imagery of, the mouth does more than just speak. The mouth swallows, like in Pi Haaretz, although we saw it's not just swallowing, it's speaking. but a mouth also spits. So the water is spitting out the air is spitting out water, but perhaps as well, there's a deeper symbolism here to the pea as not just being something that symbolizes spitting out water, but perhaps there's speech and voice and singing that comes along with this as well. So if you look in Sefer Bamidbar here, it says, Az Yashir Yisrael es Hashira Hazos Aleve Er Enu La. Then Israel sang the song, Spring up, O well, sing to it. Because these are psukim. And then they started singing a song when the well was opened up. So they're singing to the well. But Chazal have a different reading here, that it's not Be'er Enu La, that they are just singing to the well, but rather Tosos Yontov again, who's the same one who looked at the mouth of the Aretz opening up and seeing some level of talking of the earth, sees the same thing here in terms of the well. That it says here, the Rabbi quotes the Bartanura, some say that it opened its mouth and sang, as the verse says, Ale Be'er Enu La, that the well itself, not that the Jews sang, the well itself sang, i.e. they answered the words of the well. The verse is usually understood to mean they said it about the well. Tosfos Yontov explains that according to Rav, the Bartanura, the verse must be read about the well. They answered it, i.e. the song of the well was a call and response between the well and the people. So again, we have another, we can understand this. This is all miraculous. We can either understand it as that the miracle was that the water came out of the well, or perhaps there's an additional level of miracle here that the well itself actually sang. So here's another indication that we have this theme, this motif of speech related to these miracles in the desert and within the Sefer Bamidbar. Now, the third one is the Pi Ha'ason, the mouth of the donkey. And so Bilaam's donkey spoke. As I believe Freddie asked last week, don't we have other animals speaking in Chumash? So we have famously the Nachash, the serpent, the snake. So I didn't give you sources here. I'll briefly give you some answers to that question that are given in the commentaries. One simple one is that this is post Gan Eden, right? So sort of pre-Gan Eden, during Gan Eden times, there was no rules, as it were. You can't hold post-Gan Eden reality to a Gan Eden reality. So if there was happened to be talking snakes in Gan Eden, well, after they were kicked out, now it sort of restarts the clock on miracles that we find important. So perhaps the snake did speak, but that doesn't call into question the fact that we're highlighting a donkey speaking, because there's a fundamental difference between Gan Eden and post-Gan Eden. So that's one way out of it. Other ways out of it are to say that perhaps, these are interesting within the story, perhaps the snake actually wasn't speaking Hebrew, as it were, or he was speaking snake language, and Chava happened to understand snake language, right? So there was a communication going in a different direction, or perhaps there was some level of language, but it wasn't, for anybody who has a pet, there's communication, as it were. There could be communication between animals and humans. Doesn't mean that they're speaking with language itself. So there's some ways out of it that impact our understanding of that story, but for our purposes now, there's something special or unique about the donkey speaking. In fact, there are actually some, as a side point, there are some commentaries who say that even the donkey didn't speak. The donkey was communicating through its animal noises, and it was Bilaam interpreting what the donkey was saying or neighing or braying or whatever donkeys do. So it didn't actually speak, but it was the communication of animal noises. But that's not the assumption for now. The assumption here is that the donkey is speaking. So what's so special about the donkey speaking? So there's actually another question that people ask, not based on the psukim in Gan Eden, because again, let's assume Gan Eden is special, nothing to do with this miracle, that it's its own exception. But there are other indications in Tanakh of animals singing. Now, this is more midrashic than explicit within the psukim, But in Sefer Shmuel, when the Philistines, the Plishtim, send cows carrying the Aron back to the Jewish people, for those who want to see the story there in detail, it's in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Vav. The pasuk we're going to be quoting is Yud Beis. The pasuk there says that, I'll share my screen with you, with the pasuk so you can see it. Share screen. Pasuk. Okay. So, it says, Vayisharna haparos baderech al derech beis shemes, b'misila achas halchu. So the cows went straight ahead along the road to Beit Shemesh. They went along a single high road, lowing as they went and turning off neither to the right nor the left. And the lords of the Philistines walked behind them as far as the border of Beit Shemesh. Then the people in Beit Shemesh saw that the Aron came back and they were happy. So the word here, Vayisharna, on a pshat level, the pasuk seems to be saying, again, as it's translated here, they went straight. And that's also indicated in the fact that it then repeats itself and says, Lo saru yamin usmal. They didn't go right or left. So basically, the cows stayed straight. That's what the pasuk says, and it brought the Aron back to the Jewish people. So the source here, back to sharing the original page, back to the source sheets. So the source here is from a Gemara in Avodah Zarah. The Gemara looks at this word Vayisharna, Haparos Baderech, Haderech Beis Shemesh. It says, My Vayisharna. What does it mean, Vayisharna? And so it understands that the Pasuk is indicating that it's going straight, but Rabbi Yochanan is about to tell us that there's a deeper message, there's a deeper symbolism or a hidden meaning within this word Vayisharna. So Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rimeir, Sha'amru Shira. They sang songs. Vayisharna doesn't just mean straight. Shiru from Shir, they sang. So these cows sang. Zuchu Bar Tuvia Amar Rav Shiyashru Pneim Kineged Aron for Amru Shira. They straightened their faces so that they were opposite the ark, and they recited a song. So again, these cows are singing. So now you could ask, on a midrashic level, so we have other indications of animals singing, so why is it so important that, why is it so special that Bilaam's donkey spoke if we have these indications that animals sing? So, for that, let's go to the Ben Yehoyada, brings out a very beautiful idea. So, my Vayisharna HaParos. So, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Meir, that they sang Shira. So, Makshim B'Shem HaRitva. So if we're going to take this medrash literally, as it were, and we're going to assume that this actually happened, they actually sang, then it should be included in our Mishnah. Our Mishnah lists 10 things that were created, if you want to call them 10 miracles. 10 miracles that happened, Bein Hashmashos, Erev Shabbos. If these cows actually sang, this should be listed. So Viteritz, so the Ritva answers, Kfar Mana Piha Ason, Vu'avlukulon ad kan. The Ritva has an interesting answer. The Ritva says is that Pia Ason, the mouth of the donkey, is not meant to be meant that it's only the mouth of the donkey, but rather it's paradigmatic to any other case that we have of animals singing or animals speaking. So Pia Ason is any time an animal does something in its speech related manner that we find throughout either Tanakh explicitly, implicitly, it's a paradigm, it's emblematic of all those other cases. It incorporates all those other cases, so this is included, it's under the umbrella of Piha Ason. I guess that's one way of answering it. V'nira kavanaso de'osa koch shenivra b'shvila ason de'bilam shedibra bo hu atzmo chana piha paros v'dibra bo shira. So the Ben Yehoyada explains the Ritva and says that basically there's a floating miraculous power that sort of hops on from animal to animal when they need to speak for whatever purpose that was created, and that ability for an animal to speak can go on the Pia Ason, it could go on the Para, it could go perhaps on the Nachash, right? It could go to any animal that needs to speak. That power was created Bein Hashmashos. Which animal it goes on will depend on the time that it's needed. Fine. Now, that's the first explanation, but we're going to go a little bit deeper. So, the he gives another answer here. I'm going to skip it. It's interesting. It's related to our Mishnah. It jumps off of something that we saw that we skipped last week about the Me'iri, which we'll get to in the future. But let's skip these and go to the last paragraph. Va'od nira li b'siyata d'shmaya, zu ashira shashara paros ein zechidush. This singing that the cows did is not novel. It's not mind-boggling. Daha ika b'pirkei shira mikol hachayosu behemos va'ofo sha'omrim shira. We have in Perek Shira the tradition that all animals sing to God, as it were. Uperish Rabbeinu Ha'ari Zal, so the Ari Zal says, Hakavana sheyesh malach mimuna al kol davar v'chol min v'min v'hu ha'omer shira v'chol yom. The Ari Zal explains, on a mystical level, there is an angel that is appointed to every single creation, and that angel helps that creation sing a song every day. So this angel rested on the lips of this of these cows, and they sang shira. They sang praise to Hashem to the following the ark. It looks like the cows are speaking, but it's really this angel that's appointed for these animals. But this is fundamentally different from the donkey. The donkey wasn't singing songs of praise. So basically what we're saying is that there's a non-novel understanding, which in itself is pretty novel, but there's a non, it's basically understood, it's given, that animals sing praise to God. Whether you understand that on a metaphoric level, on a symbolic level, or on a mystical level, is sort of up to you. But the idea here is that that's not something newsworthy. That's known, that animals sing to God. So when we see that these cows sang praise to God, so again, either they were literally singing, I wasn't there, I don't know, or that we're saying that their actions sang praise to God. It's whether you want to read it literally or symbolically is your choice. But the point here is that has nothing to do with the Pia Ason of Bilam. That was different. That isn't singing praise of God, which we can argue is embedded within our tradition and not a novel explanation, not a novelty. But here he's arguing. And the arguments of his ability to debate with Bilam, that is not part of the classical animal sing praise to God. So our Perek Shira tradition incorporates all singing to God from animals. That's not novel. Bilam's donkey arguing with him is different, and that's why it's included here as part of the 10. So whichever direction you want to go in, whether you go with the Ritva's answer that all animals singing on some level is included within this explanation of the donkey speaking, and that's, again, emblematic or paradigmatic for all other cases, or you go with the Ben Yoyada's approach at the end here, that it's a different type of speaking, that there's praise, songs of praise, which is given, and this is more of a chiddush, a novelty, that Bilam's donkey is arguing. What you see either way with all three of these concepts is that the concept of speaking, even in the case of Pia Aretz and Pia Be'er, which you could have explained as P representing swallowing of the Aretz, Pia Be'er representing spitting of the water, Piaton is obviously talking. All three of them can be understood in terms of language, of speech. And that's what the Tosfos Yom Tov brought out, and that's here what the Ben Yoyada is bringing out at the end. So with this, I'm going to point out two more to keep in mind, because Dr. Zornberg is going to reference it. Keep in mind the Mateh, the staff of Moshe, as well as the Mazikin, the demons that were created on this Erev Shabbos Bein Hashmashos, as well as the question we posed last week, which we'll hopefully address again in the future, but the question of what is the symbolism of these things being created on Erev Shabbos Ben HaShemashos, right before Shabbos came in, at the last second. Is there a deeper symbolism there? Okay, so with all that in mind, let us explore Dr. Zornberg's works. Okay, I did not send this to you. You'll have to follow my screen. Here we go. Okay, so as you can see here, I don't know how much of this we're going to end up doing. It really depends on time of and difficulty of understanding, but hopefully we'll get to a decent chunk of this. I have here 10 pages where scattered throughout the book. So it's a very relatively long book, 300 and something pages, and this theme pops up over and over and over again, and it really starts with this in the introduction. It says, speech in the wilderness, Debor in the Midbar, the prophet Hosea dreams of restored intimacy with his estranged wife, reconciliation between God and his people. Therefore I will seduce her, lead her through the wilderness, Hamidbar, and speak, Vidibarti, to her heart. Okay, so in the Pasuk in Hosea, the two words are juxtaposed next to each other, Hamidbar and Vidibarti. The word Midbar is juxtaposed with Vidibarti. Wilderness and speech share the same root, but they are opposites. The Midbar lacks human markings or human language. It is the non-human space that Yirmiyahu speaks of. They did not say, where is God who brought us up from the land of Egypt, who led us through the wilderness, a land of deserts and pits, a land of drought and darkness, a land no man had traversed, where no human being had dwelt. Okay, so there's a lacking, there's almost a pits, drought, no speech in the desert, yet the words share the same root. So they're same root, but opposites. The land of deserts and pits was once the site of one specific pit, Joseph's pit, which his brothers explicitly describe as such. Throw him into this pit, which is in the wilderness. Again, the reference to the wilderness seems redundant. So the Ramban elaborates on Reuven's meaning. That is, the pit is deep, so he cannot get out, and it is in the wilderness. So even if he cries out, no one will save him, for no one passes by. The end of the paragraph here, the Midbar is the very world of such pits and such unheard cries. Nobody could hear you in the Midbar. There's nobody there. It's desolate. It's a desert. It's deserted. And she quotes a medrash here, Dibur Bamidbar, language in the wilderness. The paradox resonates strangely. The sages go so far to say that in some sense the two, language and wilderness, are one. Ein Dibur Elamidbar. Right? That's a paradox. Ein Dibur, there is no speech except in the desert. But desert represents lack of speech, not being heard. Some essential link, top of page 9, exists between the void place and the genius of language. Here God spoke to human beings and was acknowledged by them. Such knowledge in the wilderness is the drama recalled by the later prophets. But how are we to understand such a meeting of words and knowledge in a world of absence? For the wilderness bewilders. It undermines the very ability to speak, to know one's own experience. Its emptiness dwarfs the force of one's imagination. It is the burial site of the great enterprise of redemption that lies at the heart of this book. And so it's this paradox, she says, is the entire book of explaining the whole Sefer Bamidbar, is the paradox that is out of this place where there is no language, where there's desolation, it's wilderness, where speech, the power of language, actually comes to the fore. It is in the desert that God speaks to us, that we hear his word. So this paradox is going to be a theme throughout Sefer Bamidbar. And again, we're going to try to look at some excerpts from her writings to get a better understanding of this paradox and what perhaps we can learn out of this idea of speech. So it's the Midbar is a starting place. Out of it, language may emerge. So let's scroll down here. Let's now go to Moshe. Okay. Moshe, if you're... Freda.
But in the Midbar, there's no distractions. Because it's so desolate, because there's no other speech, there's no distractions. And that's why everything that happened to Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar could happen. Or Har Sinai and everything. It was literally nothing to distract.
Well, they found stuff to get distracted by. But, it's a fair point, but, you know, it doesn't take away the fact that there's a paradox here, right? The Midbar is a place of desolation, of lack of language, and it is specifically here where this happens. It's happening for a reason. That's correct. There's a reason for this. So now, if the speech, the theme of speech in Moshe's life plays a really important role. Right, so for those who are keeping track of Moshe's life, he has a speech impediment. He has difficulty speaking. So let's see a little bit about this. So
by the way, Midbar is from the bar, not to talk. To refrain from talking is a Midbar.
Okay.
From talking. And it's Siag LaChokhmah Shtika. Sometimes not talking is the greatest talking.
Okay.
You know?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Good. Thank you. So there's a interesting story where a cryptic story where Moshe's son is being attacked by some being. And Tzipora saves him by giving him a bris mila. So Dr. Zornberg points out that mila is actually word. So it's a bris mila, but the mila is also word. So there's a language thing going on over there as well. But the word mila also refers to the word. The whole strange narrative has pivoted on the need for language. Both sexuality and speech are forms of communication with the world. There's context to that statement, which you could read previously if you want to. I do recommend buying the book so you can read the previous pages to see the context for that statement. But both sexuality and speech are forms of communication with the world, and both are constituted by a kind of limitation, a reduction of power. Moses resists entering the symbolic world that requires relinquishing an uncompromised inwardness. He is required to be born into the powerful but vulnerable world of language. So what Dr. Zornberg is developing is that language is taking what's inside of me, perhaps what's deep inside of me, something that once I look for the words in order to communicate it to the world, it's automatically a limitation. The words limit my inner being, the deepness within me. So Moshe, she's arguing, is resisting that speech, is resisting that ability to communicate. To communicate is to connect to others. Moshe is going to have to learn how to do, but part of that inability to speak, she argues, is symbolic of that he wants to stay inward. And here the Mila as circumcision, as the word, this brief narrative engages in wordplay to make its point. Even the strange reference to the hotel Malon can be read as part of Moses' dream text. A narrative medium is woven in which God's intention is played out. So now Moshe's resistance to language, she argues, mystical traditions at the bottom of this page support the idea that Moses in this matter different from other human beings. His speechlessness represents an excess, not a defect. In this sense too, circumcision of the lips is an apt metaphor. Unlike others, he is not born into the language process. He will need to undergo a late rebirth, which will involve a late circumcision. So again, it's the same point here in terms of that speech is limiting. Moshe's inability to speak is actually in excess. It's on some level a positive point in terms of his holiness. But in order to become Moshe, he also needs to be able to learn how to speak. And she quotes here the Maharal, which gives an interesting background to the idea that we perhaps are familiar with, that a baby in the womb learns all of Torah, and then the child gets tapped on the mouth by an angel, and then forgets the Torah that it learned. So it says here, she writes, at the close of the discussion, Maharal characterizes Moses as one who never experienced this moment of humanization. In some sense, he retains the oceanic awareness, knowing the whole Torah in its entirety, of the unborn infant. His mouth and tongue and lips have never moved with the complex human desire to compensate for the loss that constitute one as human. Right? So to go into this world, we lose some of that holiness and we're hit on the mouth, and then we have to learn it all from scratch. Moshe, on some level, did not have that, so he always had this sort of holiness to him, which lacked that ability to communicate. He kept all of the Torah within him. In Maharal's dramatic reading, she concludes this section, a trauma of loss and mourning initiates speaking life. Moses is the exceptional person who continues to trail clouds of glory well into adulthood. For him, the entry into language represents an acceptance of structures and conventions that will narrow his inner world. It requires a choice to join the human world, a conscious act of circumcision. Indeed, from the moment he speaks of his uncircumcised lips, he has already made that choice. So again, what she's arguing here is that speech limits my inner world. It puts constructs, it puts constraints on what I'm feeling inside. So in order to be a part of this human and, what she's going to eventually argue, limited, broken on some level, world, we require that ability to communicate. Moshe resists that in the beginning and needs to learn how to enter into a world of communication, of language. So continuing here, if you're not realizing, because I some of the page numbers are cut off here, this is, again, not one chapter. This is scattered throughout. So she's developing this theme throughout the entire book. So next concept, going from Moshe to now Korach. Okay, remember, Pi Ha'aretz is the first thing in our Mishnah, that it swallows up Korach's followers. So language is important to understand the whole Korach story as well. Here, look at the top of this page, page 173. The ground under them burst asunder, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up. The text insists on the grotesque oral imagery of Moses' scenario. That the ground bursts asunder and the rebels go down to the underworld is apparently not sufficient to convey the scene. The earth must become a maw yawning wide, swallowing up its victims. When does this moment of oral horror arrive? With great precision, the narrative presents the timing, if you remember this from last week. Scarcely had he finished speaking all these words. So the second Moshe finished speaking, then the mouth of the Aretz opens up. Moses finishes speaking all these words. He comes to the end of words, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows. Implicitly, a tension is set up between speaking and eating, the two oral functions. As long as Moses speaks, the mouth of the earth remains closed. When it opens, it is not to speak, but to consume. The terrible alternative to spoken words is the cataclysm of final and irrefutable revelations. Moses had, as it were, exhausted all the resources of language so that nothing remained but the brute apocalypse. The limitation of human language, indeed, is that words can never achieve their finality, the last word of the consuming earth. And so there's a limit to Moshe is now trying to communicate, but at a certain point, the words don't click. the people don't listen. And when that communication ends, when he has nothing more to say, when the other people aren't getting it, then there's destruction. The mouth of the earth opens up and swallows them in. And these are deep ideas, but she continues developing this in the next page that I copied here. Fascinating medrash. The medrash says, she quotes it here in translation, "With all these arguments, Moses tried to win Korach over. Yet you did not find that the latter returned him any answer." So Moses is trying to convince Korach. Korach's not responding. This is because he was clever in his wickedness and thought, "If I answer him, I know quite well that he is a very wise man and will present and will presently overwhelm me with his arguments, so that I shall be reconciled to him against my will. It is better that I should not engage with him." When Moses saw that there was no good to be got from him, he took leave of him. So Moses is trying to talk to Korach. Korach strategically doesn't answer because he knows he's going to lose the debate. So then what does Moshe do? So Moshe calls Dasan and Aviram. So Moses sent to call Dasan and Aviram. They too persisted in their wickedness and did not deign to answer him. And they said, "We will not come up. These wicked men are tripped up by their own mouth." Right? They said, "Lo na'ale, we will not come up." So the Midrash is saying that their speech actually hurt them. "There is a covenant made with the lips, for they died and went down into the bottomless abyss after they had gone down alive into the underworld. So they say, 'We will not go up.' It means they will fall." So they actually prophesied on some level, predicted, foreshadowed what's going to happen to them when they say, "We're not going to come speak to you, Moshe." And Moses was very angry. Why? Because when a man argues with his companion and the other answers him in argument, he has satisfaction. But if he does not answer, he feels grieved. And anybody's ever had an argument with somebody and the other person stonewalls, stays silent, doesn't answer? It's a very frustrating experience. And the Midrash here is saying Moshe got angry because he's trying to communicate and they are not responding. So look what she does with this Midrash. So in this view, the Midrash, Moses attempts to make peace with Korach, who is too canny to respond. Korach considers Moses' power with words to be dangerous, seductive. Perhaps it is language itself that he senses as treacherous. Better to avoid any relationship in which communication is given free play. Observing that there is no good, no benefit to be got of him, Moses turns to Dasan and Aviram. What had Moses hoped for in addressing Korach? At best, presumably to win him over, convince him to abandon his rebellion. But perhaps Moses had hoped at least simply for dialogue, for words in reply to his words. So he gives up, he goes to Dasan and Aviram, and then their words also refuse dialogue. They say, "Lo na'ale." And again, she highlights this, that they're foreshadowing, they're foretelling their fate, that they will not come up, they will actually go down into the abyss. They will not come up. Lo na'ale. Perhaps indeed, last paragraph on the page, they are not so much foretelling as testifying to the course they are already set upon. Rejecting language, refusing to treat with Moses, they are already turned toward death. The biblical motif of the silence of the grave is implicit here. The dead shall not praise God, nor any that go down into silence, says the psalmist. And she develops, I think I might have, here it is. Let's see. I might have skipped a page, 1 second. Yeah, so basically what she says here is that if you keep in mind that Moshe's worst fear is not being able to be heard. Right, he says that, you know, "You're going to send me, and ani arel svasayim." They're not going to listen to me. I'm not going to be able to communicate. And here in the Korach story, you can imagine the frustration that not just that he's any person who they're not listening to, but this is his worst fear, that they're not going to be able to hear him, not going to be able to communicate well. And that's basically what they're doing. They're not listening. They're not communicating. So that frustration comes out, and again you see the motif of speech coming through. look at this. What happens when they're all swallowed up? It's not letting me make this bigger. Technical difficulties.
I can relate.
Okay. You'll have to survive without the text here. But basically she says that it's interesting that what happens when they go down. So they get swallowed by the earth. And then they are... Does anybody remember the Medrash? What happens to them when they get swallowed by Korach's... followers.
They start to yell. I remember that God is great, God is one, that they're praises of God.
They start singing praise of God, right? So they're standing in the abyss. His children, according to the Midrashic tradition, didn't get totally swallowed up. They sort of stood on a ledge. They found an escape hatch, as it were. And it is from there that they sang praises to God. So they... redeemed their ability to speak by singing these praises to Hashem.
Moshe emet v'koach badai.
Right. Yeah. So that's
his sons were saved. That's how we got Shmuel.
Right. That's what the Medrash tells us. So. Okay, one or two more things before we call it a day. There's an interesting thing with his staff that requires more elaboration. But his staff also, there's a discussion, did it work when he spoke Hashem's name? Or did it have its own ability to create even without speech? So especially if you put in the element of speech into the use of the staff, then another one of the 10... of the miracles have to do with speech. So the staff wasn't just a staff on its own. The staff had to do with speech. And that really leads into the discussion related to the Pi HaBe'er, which is Moshe hitting the rock. Right. So that whole episode of, it's twice in the Torah, one time for the first generation in the desert, he speaks to the rock, the water comes out. That itself is a miracle alluded to in our Mishnah. The second time he's told to speak the first time he hit the rock and the water comes out, and that's what's supposed to happen. The second time he's told to speak to the rock and instead he hits the rock, and that's the whole episode and scene where now he's no longer allowed to go into Israel. So there's, I'm not going to develop it now just for the sake of time and simplicity, but you can see there that this running theme continues, that there's an element of speech, of communication. What was originally done through hitting, it's not a good form of communication, is now supposed to be done through speech. Moshe was supposed to develop his power of speech, as it were, and he doesn't, and that's a fatal sin that now doesn't allow him to go. His inability to use his communication at that point in time sealed the deal for his entering into the land of Israel. So you see speech at the end plays an important role as well. There's an interesting, very fascinating point by the Netziv, Emek Davar, where he writes that the speaking to the rock was actually words of Torah. You should have sat down, I think the Rabbi Toker spoke about this a few weeks ago in Shul, that you're supposed to sit down and speak words of Torah to the rock, in front of the rock. There's a Medrash says that. What's the symbolism of that Medrash? So then Siv develops a beautiful idea where he says that this was actually a transitional point, and this fits with interesting themes in our Mishnah itself. The transition point was going from miraculous to life in Eretz Yisrael, which was not blatant miracles. So we're going from blatant miracles to normal mundane life. And what you see in this episode is that what you should have done, Moshe, was use speech, was use tefillah, was use Talmud Torah, Divrei Torah, in order to model how it is that you're going to, when you get into Eretz Yisrael, this is how you're going to communicate to God. You're not going to communicate through miracles. You're going to communicate through speech of Torah and speech of tefillah. And really, that's how we, unlike this Mishnah, which is referencing the miracles, we interact with God with the power of speech on a deep but non-explicitly miraculous level through Torah and through tefillah. And that's what Moshe was supposed to model for the Jewish people. But again, he messed up and hit the rock instead. Obviously, she talks here about Bilam and the importance of speech. That runs through the symbolism as well of the importance of speech. Bilam used his speech again for negative. He was trying to curse the Jewish people. He abused his power of speech. And there's an irony here that subverts his point, is that the donkey actually speaks what God wants him to speak, but Bilam doesn't know how to speak what God wants him to speak. So again, the theme of speech, inability to use speech, of language, of communicating, comes up there as well. I'm going to close with one point and foreshadow one point that we'll start with next week. She ends this in her last chapter by pointing out the irony of Sefer Dvarim. You go from Sefer Bamidbar, which is this paradox of speech, of a place where there is no speech, where we're communicating, where we're struggling to learn how to communicate, where we're struggling to learn how to take what's inside of us and present it to other people, to almost break ourselves on some level, to limit ourselves, to constrain ourselves in order to be able to communicate effectively with other people, and the frustrations that come out when that process does not go well. And then all of a sudden, Moshe, who is not an Ish Bal Dvarim, who does not know how to speak, who does not know how to communicate, but is learning and struggling through that process, all of a sudden, Sefer Dvarim, he's the communicator par excellence. He turns into this magnificent orator and somebody who's the Moshe Rabbeinu, our teacher, and he can't stop talking. That's all he's doing, nonstop, at the end of his life. He's just talking and talking and talking. We love it, and we read it, and we want to read more and more and more and more, but there's this total transformation of Moshe to somebody who now goes from somebody who's a heavy mouth, a heavy tongue, uncircumcised lips, to somebody where he becomes Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe the teacher. And in, there's an explosion of language here that presumably has been figured out through the frustrations, through the difficulties, through the constant struggles in the desert, in this place, again, a paradox of communication, where it was so difficult to go through that process, but through it, Moshe, and hopefully we, learn the power and the importance of communicating effectively. The power of speech, of taking the deep parts within us and be able to present that to other people in a clear, non-hostile fashion that they can understand, that they can listen and receive, and that we can listen to them. That process of communication is essential to our lives. It's essential to our religious lives. It's essential to our relationships. It's really, according to some, what it means to be human, is that ability to use language and our power of speech to communicate. And if that's the case, what we see, bringing it back to our Mishnah, which this is going to foreshadow what we're going to do next time, we're going to see a very fascinating Sfas Emes that she quotes that pulls all this together into our Mishnah, is that this power of speech that's given to these three objects, the piha ason, the piha aretz, and the piha be'er, two of them inanimate, one donkey doesn't know how to speak, but now they're given the power of speech. There's something miraculous, not just about them, this miracles of speech, but perhaps, and she doesn't say this, but perhaps as, we can argue, that even humans being able to communicate effectively, there's something miraculous about that. So these miracles that are created Bein HaShemashos for these inanimate objects to be able to speak, and the fact that God has to embed that within creation, perhaps is symbolic of our struggles with speaking and communicating, and that you know, we want to learn how to daven, we want to learn how to learn Torah, we want to learn how to communicate appropriately and ethically and morally and effectively with our friends, and to some level that, or even with our people we disagree with, perhaps even more importantly, to some extent, some of that is miraculous, and we need to learn from this Mishnah some effective messages. So with that, we'll close. We're not done with this idea, although hopefully next time we won't have technical issues, as well as it's going to be not as heavy on the text reading from Dr. Zornberg, but we're going to bring this into a full development with one last passage from her, and then we're going to transition back to the regular scheduled type of Mefarshim analysis that we do on the Mishnah. We'll probably spend one more shir in total on this Mishnah before we go into the rest of the Perek. Next week, we will not be having a shir. Okay, so we're going to take 1 week off. We're going away. Don't come next week. You can come, but I won't be here. 2 weeks, we should be back to normal.